philosophers in space, 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 space.
Oops, ain't gonna cut it, Mr. Glowing Visage, beautiful beyond all description.
These are my disposables, exposition and comic relief.
No functions.
Darling, those are genders.
I would like to see the baby.
If it makes you feel any better, the apocalypse is coming soon. Bury your gold. You've been buying gold, right?
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. This is episode 199. I'm Thomas. That's Aaron. How you doing?
I'm feeling conflicted. I don't know. I'm feeling great. I miss QED deeply. That was a lot of fun, and I have deep withdrawal, but also COVID. So
deep withdrawal,
those things are necessarily related.
COVID.
I don't, you know. Yeah. I don't necessarily get it from the conference, but I certainly have the withdrawal from the conference.
Yeah. I have just a regular cold, so you know, there's nothing barely noteworthy. Why did I even mention it? Yeah,
that's exciting. Yeah.
I'm also up here in my space station playing space grab ass. A lot of space grab ass.
Right. You'd think if you were up in your space station, you'd get less cold.
Yeah,
because, like, where
that's
are you
a good
them
point.
From?
I think if you got a cold just floating in a satellite, it would be like a major, you'd be like, wow, what's happening? Although maybe, I don't know, maybe you'd figure shit's just, virus is just like hanging around, you know? Sort of like how there's always that, isn't there always that like strep something, or that there's always that certain bacteria on your skin that, what is that again?
Right, that could just mutate and attack you whenever.
Something
once,
horrible though.
Staff, yeah, no, I would assume. That's what it is. I would assume in space, because everything is worse, that also getting sick is worse, and there's just, you know, space microbes that mutate and attack you instantly or something.
Well, we watched another episode of the Star Trek.
Orville.
The Orville, yeah.
New Horizons.
The Enterprise, new Star Treks, Orville, New Horizon. Mm-hmm. Family Guy, colon.
Star Trek Family Guy edition, yes, correct.
It's kind of a sequel to last time.
It is pretty wild. I mean, if you had told me that, like, Family Guy dude was going to be, you know, doing really, really social justice-y, woke Star Trek, I would not have believed you or thought that it was going to
Good
go well.
Point.
And I actually think that, for the most part, it goes pretty well.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. I mean, so many of his ilk have not gone well, but I can't think of, you know, he's not like a TERF in his off time, is he? I don't know.
Not to my knowledge.
Cool.
No. And I mean, to my understanding is, like I said, like we talked about in the last one, this season gets more woke because they, I guess, were feeling more able to do so, no longer being at Fox.
Sweet.
So I think, if anything, he was probably feeling constrained on these things. It's interesting. And, you know, thinking back through, like, Family Guy stuff as compared to South Park, I do think there is a difference there in terms of their, like, South Park's kind of radical libertarian attack everyone policy, whereas Family Guy was just, it was mean sometimes, but, like, different. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The targets were different. The approach was different, I guess.
You know, here's the funny thing. I was just trying to check. I want to make sure that we hadn't missed, you know, him being terrible. I don't think he's on Twitter. That's actually a major contributor to not having your brain melted by TERFs if you're one of that kind of generation, is not being on Twitter. Unless I'm really missing something, I search. Yeah, no, nothing.
Soon enough, we'll all benefit from that, I suppose.
Cool. Well, that's how you do it. Hey, if you're listening and you're, you know, like an older kind of Gen X and you don't want to just completely lose touch with reality, follow the Seth MacFarlane model of not going on Twitter and just not having a Twitter. It really...
It'll be easy because soon you'll just not pay $8 to not go on Twitter and not learn these terrible things.
Oh, God, he's going to run it to the ground. It's so good. Love it.
Seem like that's going to happen, which makes me sad because I like Twitter, even though it also ruins people.
Yeah. Well, maybe you should pay your $8. I don't know. Have fun. Have fun, big guy.
I think that's not going to happen, but we'll burn that bridge.
All right. Well, also wanted to tease a pretty major show announcement. We're going to do that at the end of the show, so make sure to stick around. Major news. But in the meantime, I think we had better go ahead and bop it into the exposition zone.
You're traveling through another dimension, beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
And we're using the episode term loosely again here, right? This is like episodes or something. Just going as long as it wants. It's like end of season HBO kind of show,
and,
right?
Okay, so this like, one I took offense 20, to it because 30. There was so much filler in this episode, I'll be honest. There's a lot of space grab ass. You know, I said that I was feeling positively toward the Orville after the last episode. After this one, I'm back to like, yeah, sorry. I just don't, it's not great.
That's fine. I think these are the two that are really worth watching from this season for the most part. I don't think that like there's a necessity to watch other things there. And certainly the things that you don't like about this episode, I'm guessing, are going to be things you will like dislike about other episodes from the season.
A lot of space
well.
Grab ass.
Which is fine. Like, I don't think it's got to be a brilliant show. I just think it's got some interesting, brings up some interesting questions for me in this episode that go beyond, I think, sort of normal debate about gender identity and gender affirming care that we talked about last time.
A lot of space grab ass, a lot of interesting problems set up and then totally sidestepped. I feel like that's my biggest complaint. It's like you set up these moral quandaries and then you're like, but what if
sitcom
you
style.
Just didn't have to answer that? Because,
right.
Yeah, what if there's
what
enough
if
space grab ass
out of
so
the hole we dug?
All of those problems go away? But that's okay. We can still still plan.
I hear
to
what you're saying.
About.
It's a sitcom.
So what happens is we start off and we're on the like hidden secret colony of, is it Mocklins? Mocklin females, Lady Mocklins.
Yeah, Lady Mocklins.
As you'll recall, they are not allowed in Mocklin culture. There's only males in Mocklin culture, and they're anti-female, and they do gender reassignment surgery if any female Mocklin are born. And so, but then we had that whole revolution. We talked about all that. So it looks like this colony is kind of trying to grab a foothold. There's this weird, it's not officially recognized. It's like a, you know, its own society, its own planet or anything. And so there's this tense arrangement with the Mocklin home planet, where the Federation or whatever is kind of protecting them, but not full on. So, you know, it's a tenuous position. And then you get, Topa is approached by the old lady Mocklin, and the old lady Mocklin wants to give her like a secret mission or something. We don't really hear what that is. And then through
very Harriet Tubman Mocklin vibe here, right? Like that's what you're picking up as well, kind of Mocklin Railroad.
It ends up being that, yeah, she's going to have all the codes to communicate with the Mocklin source on the Mocklin planet. Now that I think about it, why do they need that? I don't understand. If they're already communicating with whoever that is, why does she need to do it? I don't know. Something secret hidden plans.
Yeah. It may not actually even matter. It may be a bluff anyway, but in any case, there's something about needing someone to send signals back and forth safely.
And then through a thing that now I, in retrospect, don't understand, a blue thing that's supposed to be rare, a blue firefly type thing on this planet, leads her to be kidnapped. So was that like a fake one or something, or was that just coincidence? Just really, wow, what a...
I think it was
what
just
an
coincidence.
Awful coincidence.
I mean, I imagine that those people were hanging around waiting to kidnap this child, and at some point this child wandered off because, again, child.
So like, oh, very lucky that
gotta progress the plot.
Extremely
here.
Rare firefly led her to a perfect place for kidnapping. So they must have been really just counting their lucky stars on that one. And so they kidnap her.
You know, maybe they have magic control over bugs. I'm not
they
deep on the Mocklin.
They kidnap her, and she's gone, and they're looking for her. And now, somehow, they instantly have known that she was going to be the secret source, despite the fact that she wasn't even supposed to be visiting. Like, the girl kind of convinced them to take Topa to that planet last minute anyway. You know, the more I talk about this, nothing really makes sense in this episode. Whatever. Yeah. So all that series of coinkydinks. Anyway, so the Mocklins instantly have her. And that's the weird thing is it's it's not as though they were just trying to kidnap her to make a political thing, which I think you could have just done. Like, you could have just had the Mocklands slowly trying to get rid of the female colony or something. They're kidnapping her because, coincidentally, they instantly knew she was going to have the secret source. And also, so they're chasing her. We get some meaningless... You get this space grabbers where Kelly and Topa's dad, who's there, they get on their little mini ship, and there's somehow that's been sabotaged, which, okay, fine, fair enough. It's been sabotaged by the Mocklands, apparently. And there's this meaningless, like, oh, we can't, it's broken, but not, I don't know what the point of this was. It's broken, but not enough to matter.
I think, you know, it's just got to be like a team building exercise, right, to get them back to being friends, and then they go yeah, and but save they don't the kid, do, basically. The
ship being broken doesn't factor into virtually anything. I guess it's a reason why they can't, yeah, actually.
I don't remember in particular.
It doesn't factor into anything. It's not broken enough to matter, so they follow the Mocklin ship, and that's what they're doing for the whole time. And then over on, yeah, I guess Earth or whatever, we get the Federation, like the whole conflict of, the political conflict of... Well, we can't really do anything because we don't have any proof that the Mocklands did this. And, of course, we need the Mocklands for this, you know, alliance against the space robots. And, yeah, Victor Garber, who I love. I'm glad to see he's still working. He's one of my favorite actors ever. He is, you know, President Mr. Federation, I guess. And he is... saying that they can't, their hands are tied right now. I guess unless old lady Mocklin confesses to the whole plot, because then that puts enough evidence into the broad daylight to where they can say, okay, even though you were doing that against the rules, we now can acknowledge that Topa is missing and that maybe Topa is, or at least, yeah, acknowledge enough facts to where
investigation.
An investigation can be voted on, apparently. Yeah, it makes sense. There's a lot of diplomacy going on. And, I mean, I'm realizing this is so easy to describe the plot because there's like 3 minutes of plot and a bunch of grab ass. So there, she initially doesn't agree to do that until she gets visited by a ghost of Christmas future past. Which is...
standard.
Sure.
Not outside the realm of Star Trek, let's be honest here, right? Yeah. Like, that's pretty run of the mill for Star Trek.
Seth MacFarlane puts her in the holodeck, and Dolly Parton visits her. And
That is pretty good. Hero, it's a pretty good Dolly Parton cameo. You got to admit that, like, especially after, like, three episodes of references, like, it's pretty funny.
You can get a really corny Dolly Parton song, and that's enough to convince her to do what is a really terrible decision, which is put at risk the entire female Mocklin colony for the sake of one person. So that's a very bad decision. But the lesson, the way Dolly Parton convinces her is, well, if you just do the right thing, then the writers will make sure that the plot works out. She's like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll do that. But I imagine you would say this is something of a... what's the term I can never remember? I mean, this is the doing the virtuous thing despite it might not have the best consequences.
Doing the right thing just because it's the right thing. Non-consequentialism.
Yeah, probably virtue ethics, right? It's the virtue ethics decision. Just kind of making sure to do the right thing, even though you're ignoring that it's definitely the wrong thing to do. Definitely.
Is it though?
Because we think it's not the wrong thing to do because the camera is only fixed on one child that we're empathizing with. But if you fix the camera on a bunch of other children in the colony who are going to die, then you'd be like, oh, well, shoot, it doesn't really make sense to kill a bunch of children for the sake of one child. But, you know, conveniently, the cameramen of the show, camera people, are only filming the one child that we are supposed to care about. So. Again, it's a way to make things abundantly clear.
I'm just glad that you're throwing down all these markers that these are going to be easy problems to solve. So then when we
it's not easy. It's just
problems,
it's
it'll be
just
fun.
Again, it's a trolley. It's a trolley problem where you're zooming into the. No, I mean it's a traumatic, horrible decision. Is all I'm saying. It's, yeah, you're right. Reaching the right conclusion is easy, But because it's just math. Like you, if you train the camera on one person in a trolley problem and don't even look at the, you know, 20,000 people on the track that are going to get run over, then you're like, oh yeah, I really want to save that one person because that's the right thing to do.
I mean, assuming you know for certain
that's how they present it.
Destroyed. If you I don't do know. This that's thing, how... right. Sure, but you know that's you're now taking them as reliable here. You know, the camera people that you were saying.
Oh, no, in what's her name's mind, in the old lady's mind, that is the decision she's making because she believes that will wipe out the colony or whatever. So if that's what you believe.
I think you would argue that she probably was hoping that like something else would happen.
She was hoping this is a TV show where it will work out. Okay, fair enough. Yeah, I got you.
I mean, I don't think it's actually unreasonable for human beings to hope that like something is going to happen if they do the right thing. I mean, well, unreasonable or not, I'm not saying I don't think it's, you know, motivationally incoherent. Right?
So she decides to testify. She testifies. We get a dramatic Federation scene and the Mocklands deny everything and yell a lot and say they're being persecuted by the system. Witness the violence inherent in the system, and they're the persecuted space minority. And then until, you know, our heroes somehow break into a dark, like, Mockland CIA site where they're interrogating the child. And despite them just having, like, two weapons and they're infiltrating what we've established is the war culture species of this universe. They break waltz right in, just shoot a couple, you know, 3-4 people easily. Bob's your uncle and they've saved the child.
I think the point is very clear that when these people are working together, these two are, you know, high level, you know, expert killing machines.
Sure.
It's the standard trope.
I feel like they could have maybe written in some sort of ingenuity or tactical advantage that would have made that make sense. But no, it's just walk in and blast. That's all. And they rescue Topa and then this quick zip, hop, skip, and a jump over to Earth. I don't know. There's instant travel in this universe. That's fine. And they put Topa up on the stand or something to show the truth has been revealed and no one has to make any hard decisions at all because everything worked out and the people believe them. And they've now, at the end of the episode, they have expelled the Klingon Mocklands from the Alliance. And you get Victor Garber, you get a quick rundown of like what a major deal this is. You know, it's like, well, you know, well, we expelled him. That's going to involve, you know, reconfiguring our entire alliance. We're now more vulnerable. We have to sell back a bunch of weapons. We have a bunch of ships that are commanded by Mocklands. We got to get, you know, redo that. We got just going down the list. And you're like, boy, maybe this wasn't the best decision. Like maybe they could have found a way to not do that. But the end, I think.
Pretty much. Yep. I like it. I think it's fun. I mean, it's got all the problems. I'll concede that it has all the problems you're describing. But as, you know, Star Trek content goes, it's got a lot of entertaining back and forths on moral issues and things that I think are worth diving into. So I don't remember if there's anything else from there that was particularly noteworthy, any scenes or anything.
Are you saying we'd better grok it?
Why don't you just tell me the right answer?
Well, that's what's so great about the trolley problem is that there is no right answer.
This is why everyone hates moral philosophy professors.
Yeah, so this one I thought was nice because it starts off with, I think, an ethical question that I think should be challenging for folks like us who are generally very sympathetic to, like, child autonomy when it comes to things like gender affirming care. And then I think there's some sort of secondary philosophical questions that sort of follow along beside that. But I wanted to start off with this sort of question that I think gets short shrift in the episode, which is whether or not it's ethical to embroil this young child in the like politics of trying to change gender laws for all Mocklands.
I would.
What are your thoughts on that particular choice?
I would like
choice?
A cleaner like setup sort of, so that know? It's, you know, because the hypothetical is rough. Like, it's like you set up a trolley problem, but where there's a million ways that you're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. It's hard. You know, I'm distracted by those because none of it makes any sense. You could have anybody else do this? Why does she, am I missing something? Why was it that she needed, that Topa needed to do this and not literally anyone else, Topa's dad even, you know, anyone else on the ship?
I think, you know, I think the implication would be something like, if we're being sort of very brutally realpolitik about this, it's that Topa is this flashpoint individual because of all of this arguments about her gender. And if she were to get caught in the process of doing this thing, that could be a flashpoint that could ignite.
So sort of, you're saying they need to have the old lady. Like, so they need to have the old lady do like a Kaiser Soze moment at the end, right? Where it's like, you know, that's what it should have been. You go to the end of the thing. You go. No, hold on. I got it.
That's what I was
you
hoping. Go to the it end of the episode. That was one
she's
of my
got
that,
a little
one of my
blue firefly putting it in the drawer or whatever. He's like, it was her all along that planned this whole conundrum. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's what they were missing. That would have made a lot more things make sense.
And I think that would have made it for a better episode. Actually, that like. Because I think they too quickly steamroll the idea that like it was unethical for her to involve Topa at all. And my pushback there, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about this comparison, especially as a parent. But, you know, if we just spent the previous whole episode arguing that Topa is of an age where they can give informed consent, that they can understand trade-offs well enough, including like, you could be isolated from your culture level trade-offs, not just like how you really, you know, what gender you really identify as kind of trade-offs. I'm not convinced that we can then say that they lack the agency needed to commit to engaging in the politics of helping other people do the exact same thing.
In really dire, like wartime circumstances, it's hard to imagine that. You know, I feel like this gets pushed to the limit where you're like, well, in normal circumstances, yeah, you should be able to give people like an easy, carefree childhood where they don't have to take these problems on the weight of their shoulders kind of thing. But that's just like not the reality of how war works or how any major conflict works, you know?
Yeah. And then I think, wait a minute, did we just justify child soldiers?
Yeah. Yep.
Right. Like if the cause is good enough and like the child is aligned enough ideologically or personally with that cause, you know,
well,
is
honestly,
the, you know, the white roses or things like that. Right.
I mean, child soldier might be, that's a bit of a stretch. But like just picture you're in some post-apocalyptic world for the sake of argument. And you have a household that you've established. Let's say that household is, or that the compound, whatever you want to envision, is attacked. You're going to be like, yeah, everybody, give your kid a gun if they are old enough. You know, everybody's going to defend their interests.
I will once again unrepentingly bring this back to Dune, the Fremen culture, the children follow along and kill and finish people off in combat. That's their job.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, they're incredibly cutthroat.
So it's like they find all the people like playing dead in the crowd, you know, and do all that?
Yeah, like all the survivors who didn't go down immediately. They go along and they finish them off and like mark them for, you know, water extraction. So that is, I think, it is an interesting question. And it's surprising to me that the show sort of immediately paints her as having done something inappropriate. Even if she was doing like the Kaiser Soze thing where it's like, I accept that this one child might be tortured to death for the sake of like bringing about the kind of social change that we need. Like,
geez, the ones who warp speed away from Omalas.
Right, but is it okay if the child's understood that they were taking a risk to do something that they thought was ethically important?
I think you would need to exhaust a lot of other possibilities before that would be remotely
sure. And I think the implication is that they've done so here in this situation to some extent, hopefully.
I guess that's little bit contradicted by the fact that like the beginning of the episode is like a long-winded, you know, house party at the colony where everything is fine. Like that, it paints a contrast with what we're to believe here.
Yeah. So I guess you could ask like the next stage of that question would be, is the situation dire enough to justify the use of child soldier sacrifice, whatever you want to call, you know, like the use of an Omalas child here.
Yeah.
which is like a hand grenade, right? You just pull the pin and throw the Omalost child at the opponents. And, you know, I think the argument would be there's a status quo, but it's an unjust peace, essentially, in that, you know, a just conflict would be better than an unjust peace, I think, would be the civil rights rejoinder there. Especially if you feel like, you know, there's a risk that that colony is already, you know, could be wiped out at any moment anyway. Mm. Why not sort of take this one chance to, you know, really bring a bunch of attention to the issue or something like that?
Makes sense. I feel like you could really just plead for cooperation from the Federation for protection.
Yeah, but that doesn't seem to be working out. And like, I think then we can ask the next question, which is, what is the obligation of the Federation, like, over the stages of this? Because you were saying you felt like it was sort of, to some extent, clear-cut about what they should be doing in each of these situations. But I think, you know, the trade-off in terms of quantity of lives versus also things like principles is, I think, a challenging question.
All right, what's your question?
You know, like, yeah. I mean, well, I think the question would be sort of the one that gets put forward in that sort of, in the negotiations that they're having, where the dude freaks out at one point and is like, you know, are we just going to let these people dictate all of our ethics because we need them for this conflict? Mm-hmm. And I think there are many situations in which, you know, we would want to say no, like we're not going to, you know, we're not going to make common cause with particular kinds of individuals, right? Everybody can, yeah, feels like they can happily say they're not going to make, you know, common cause with Nazis. But I also think, like, you know, you and I are very much in favor of the schisming of the, you know, atheist community into those who value trans rights and those who don't. Sure. And, you know, this is the same thing, basically, right? You could argue that, like, it's different because of robot armies, but, like, we are dealing with white Christian nationalists. They're almost the same thing. So,
yeah, I think the answer to this is the Federation needed to be a little more, I don't know what the word is, have a little more fortitude in negotiations prior to this, because it's not like the Mocklins are fine. Like, it's very clearly they need each other, you know, and so maybe some, like, sterner negotiation tactics. Because it also, the ending didn't make sense to me, because I feel like maybe you could have even had the Mocklins, like, you've called their bluff. Because they don't, are they really going to, like, wouldn't they have backed down, don't you think? Wouldn't they be like, all right, yeah, well, we effed up here. You got us. You called our bluff. We're not going to get rid of our entire alliance because of this. So we'll give you, like, somebody to punish or something for this whole plot.
Well, yeah, I mean, so they are, if they are a Klingon stand-in, right? You've got that honor culture. Maybe they don't back down, but honor cultures, I feel like one of the flaws of them is that they are very unreliable in negotiations in these sort of situations, because it's not clear when they're going to want to make a sort of saving face, like, retreat, mm-hmm, versus actually just brazening it out to the bitter end. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't know. I think you could argue that it would be reasonable for them to double down in this kind of way if they felt like maybe the politics of their own culture was such that if they tried to go back and sell the alternative to their own culture, they would be, you know, removed from office in whatever way Mocklins do that.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, again, it's just that they're also facing complete extinction at the hands of this robot army. Like, the way they've drawn the facts up, it's kind of weird, because it's not like they, you know, this is a massive thing. So right now, as things stood, this is why the ending doesn't make any sense. As this stood, the Mocklins have nothing. They didn't get the colony destroyed. The colony is now protected. And also, they don't have an ally against the robot army. So it just feels like they were written to be way too irrational of actors, in my opinion. But, you know, what can you do?
Well, I also think it's interesting that, like, you know, if you have this robot sword of Damocles hanging over your entire species or something, it feels very much to me like climate change. And yet at the same time, if you asked me, you know, are you going to ally with some Nazis to fight climate change? The answer is probably no. Mm. Like, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to endorse, you know, collaborating with them for those purposes. And, you know, I could try to find my argumentative outs.
Well,
I could talk
on.
About, like, let me, you know, how are they going to be helpful or something.
I feel like this is a real thing. So, like, the Saudis, mm-hmm, obviously.
Sure.
Nazi adjacent, and certainly, like, not great. But let's say they come to your negotiating table and they're like, well, let's do an agreement to curb emissions. You're going to be like, no.
Yeah, so...
Turn the questions on you, Mr. Philosopher.
I do think these are hard questions. I just think that
I don't think that's a hard question at all. I think you go, yeah, okay, we'll agree to do that.
Well, this is as cliche as the show always was, there's the moment in West Wing that I think we've probably talked about before about trying to get China economically invested so that they'll come to the table on human rights and whether that actually worked. And the response and like the quirky old guy is like, that's the hope. But of course, we also know that they're still going to have, prisoners sewing soccer balls and things. And we're not actually going to make substantial change or something like that. And it's like, so why not stick with your principles? Right. If you can't reasonably rely on them to be motivated, or if you think that all you're going to be doing is whitewashing their reputation without actually getting the benefits that are necessary. Do you walk away on something like that?
Mm. Well, we could look at what's happening in Iran right now. I am very not well read on the details of all that. I know the broad strokes of what's happening. I wonder if there will end up being any argument that, our conduct one way or the other could help or hinder those efforts. Because I think the ideal kind of not colonialist response to these things is to try to use that kind of thing. Is to try to use soft power of culture and, art and technology and media to reach the people on the ground who actually are the ones who have to be the ones making the change, the ones having a revolution kind of thing. I mean, maybe I don't know the details of I don't think this could happen in North Korea because they're so completely shut off. But the fact that Iran had some access, Iranian citizens have some access to social media and companies that were started in America and technology that started here somewhat, maybe that has allowed this organizing and this, has helped probably, I think, this movement. Mm-hmm. And if this ends up in some sort of major revolution, I don't know, maybe that says something about the right approach. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it's one thing that I enjoy about all this, because I don't think that we're going to solve, these political tensions.
We're not. Oh, man.
But I do enjoy that,
not at this Patreon level. Go to Patreon.
I know, right?
U.S. government, if you're listening.
But I enjoy that, we've looked at a bunch of these different, Trek and the culture and all these things. And as we watch these different conflicts, we ourselves, I think, kind of get pushed back and forth on stuff like the Prime Directive or what amount of hard force should you be using in your, giant intergalactic conflicts. I think, and I was pondering that because as you were talking there about the soft force, I was just watching the slide back from, a more muscly, we're gonna bring justice to the universe back toward, through a almost neoliberally kind of place into the kind of culture where all their technique is using the special units to, go and, overthrow a dictator or, seed conflict or something like that. And they're 60-year plans for toppling these different civilizations. So it's just, it's fascinating to me how science fiction kind of takes these different ideologies and spins them out to these sort of very epic levels. And then it's interesting how the different cultures, wrestle with, struggle with, and end up at different points along the solutions and how we feel about those things when they play out in these narratives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to some extent we're always unsatisfied on some levels, right? You read culture and you're like, wait, they waited 60 years to overthrow this vicious, horrible civilization and billions of people are killed in the course of that time.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why, I was making the joke about the cameraman. Or the camera person. I think it really matters where you put your focus, you know? Mm-hmm. I think that changes. We're so susceptible to that. Like, whoever's in front of us, the kid who's the focus of the story is in front of us. So we're like, yeah, of course you got to say. But like, again, if we're really talking about a situation where an entire, you know, possible little mini colony of Mauchlin females is going to be wiped out, like if you train the camera on that possibility, mm-hmm. you know, I think I think it would really affect. If we had a better way to like try to form some at least objective look at what the consequences are, like even if you're not making a decision right. about like to at least find a way to in these major things. And the truth is it's just so complicated and there's unknowns, but if you could at least form a like an accurate as possible picture of what the actual consequences will be or are currently, so that we could keep that all in mind rather than just like putting focus on one person at a time here or there, or one story here or there. I feel like that's such a major challenge in the way we go about these things.
Yeah. And I'm not sure I necessarily know that there is a perfectly like what is the exact yeah. right scope and lens and focus. And I think I love all of these science fiction stories because there's no escaping one's own kind of lens. Like, even if you try to not have a heavy-handed moral story, I think you're bringing up an important point here, which is you're always going to have to pick what you're going to write. You know, mm-hmm. it's going to be a smaller or a bigger, you know, like levels of space opera. Like, and at the end of the day, all of those choices will shape, you know, the impact of your story, right? And some of them may be more or less conscious. And I think a lot of them are sometimes very unconscious, that like the person gravitates towards personal stories in one way and that ends up, you know, shaping the morality of their entire universe. But it makes me, you know, come back to this idea that art always has a kind of implicit moral dimension to it. It mm-hmm. may not have a clear answer or moral or something like that, but you know, the culture stories, because of their, you know, scale in one book or not in the other, I think, you know, like you're saying, they convince us of one side of the argument rather than the other, mm-hmm. right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that they have solved any of these problems. It's like we're always just picking different focuses and then feeling a little more compelled by that side yeah. of things if it goes well for them.
Yeah, it's really a frustrating limit of any sort of human conflict, is this idea that like we're so much more. It's like the old experiments where people are so much more likely to donate money to a cause if you show them, you know, some small number of people suffering. But if you tell them that like, hey, 3 million people are going to die, they're like, ah, it's too, I can't, it's too big of a number, right. Can't care.
Right. You just tap out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a lot of work to do before breakfast. You must have a very busy schedule.
I feel like we didn't get enough, and maybe it's because I just don't watch television. I feel like we didn't get enough of that zoomed in human stories of COVID. I feel like there was some, and again, this could be very colored by how I receive my information, which is I mainly read stuff on the news, but you know, podcasts and other things and documentaries. Has there been like the consensus or, you know, the Ken Burns documentary of like, yeah, here's a look into a bunch of the human toll of COVID that, you know, aired in prime time that we all know about. You know what I mean? I just don't know how much of that there was. And it's easy, I think, for a lot of people on the right to just completely ignore this massive number of people who have died of COVID and just pretend it didn't happen or something.
I do think we'll probably see more of that in the, you know, in the coming years, potentially.
Yeah, definitely.
But it, you know, I think there's an interesting sort of implication. I don't know necessarily that you would say this explicitly, but I think certainly some folks lean very much towards the idea that like good ethics is when you can envision all the people who are suffering and take all of them into account, and bad ethics is when you only care about like the 10 people around you or something like that. And you know, it's an intuition that I am sympathetic to, but also, you know, want to push back on to some extent, because I do think there are interesting ethical theories like care ethics that argue that no, like you don't need to turn yourself into an aggregator machine in order to be a good ethicist.
No. Yeah, I agree. I think it depends on the issue. Like when we're talking about a binary decision, mm-hmm. Where you're doing one thing or the other, I think that's where it's like, no, you really need to do your best to have a accurate picture of all the consequences of either of those decisions to the best you can. But I do mm-hmm. agree with you that like, I think there absolutely has to be some line drawn to where we don't all have to feel obligated at all times to be trying to make like the most ethical decision with respect to like every possible, you know, outcome and every right. possible person. I think that is sort of like in my rule utilitarian brain, I would say like, yeah, if we all were required to do that at all times, it would be so unworkable and like stressful and impossible that it like that harm would outweigh the benefit.
No utility pumps. But then, of course, once you've, you know, said, all right, fine, I'm not going to just maximize till everybody dies. I'm going to cap it at some point. Then you start this like frustrating slide of like, where do you cap it? You know, is it like and this is a Peter Singer problem for sure. He talks about mm-hmm. like, you know, is it at the point of marginal utility, at the point, you know, of like you're suffering a little bit, at the point of, you know, half of what you have, or, you know, like where is the right point at which you can say, no, I'm going to privilege, I'm going to benefit, you know, me and mine over others.
Yeah, that's a tough line to draw.
Yeah, and some like people will argue that instead of like forcing people to make these decisions, what you want is a society where people can be the care ethics kind of, you know, culturally, socially, you know, community oriented individuals that they want to be, and that won't involve them, you know, doing unethical things under capitalism or something like that, right? That like, it shouldn't be that our system requires me to be able to conceptualize the suffering I'm causing on the other side of the planet, because as you pointed out, we're not good at it. We're very bad at it.
Yeah. That's why we need complete mm-hmm. omniscient AI, right?
Mm. But then I think that raises an interesting question. If we go back to the Orville, right? Should I really try to be taking into account like this giant cosmic war, or should I just be advocating for like Tulpa, or advocating for female Mocklins?
Tulpa?
And what is her name? Tulpa? Tulpa? Tulpa?
Yeah.
Tulpa?
Did we summon a Tulpa?
We summoned a Tulpa.
Nice.
Yeah.
Tulpa.
That's their fault. That's not my fault. They could have picked a better name. Yeah, I think that's, you know, like there's a joke. I don't know if we actually talked about this one before, the Saturday morning breakfast cereal about the 100 livers guy who like.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Again, you know, just a wrap, you know, something that we've talked about before, but it comes back here where I feel like just being able, the ability of science fiction to say, okay, but what if the number of people who are going to die is 20 gajillion trillions, right? Like, does that just break ethics at that point in a way that, in the same way that like recent discussion of long-termism, and we've talked about that some on the show, right? That like, if you can improve the well-being or save a trillion people 1,000 years from now, are you actually obligated towards that, or is that just kind of like a Pascal's wager for utilitarians?
I think that you can certainly heavily discount hypothetical people over real people, but I don't know that like making the possible cost, you know, dialing it up to a billion, in my view, doesn't break morality. I think it just makes it might if you're not a utilitarian, but for me, it's like, no, yeah, you gotta bite the bullet. Gotta kill old Johnny 100 livers or whatever, I guess.
I wonder, like, can you really make an ethical argument? For example, I'm not saying you, but like, could one really make an ethical argument for saying, look, we're not going to ally with the, you know, snake monster aliens because they actually keep literal slaves, but we are going to ally with the creepy capitalist Ferengi Jew people because, you know, like their women,
they control the banks,
seem somewhat into it, I guess, or something like, you know, like, or like, you know, is it okay to say no slave cultures, but yes to cultures that marginalize women or trans people or something
have
like
slavery,
that?
Slavery, right? But like, with more steps or whatever.
Right. Like, is it really just slavery with more steps? And is that a problem? And like, you know, yes.
Is slavery with more steps a problem?
What I'm saying is, you know, if you have a culture that, you know, controls its women to the point of slavery.
Yeah. I think it just comes down to the details of what that alliance is and like what you're doing. You know, I mean, like I said, I feel like if you sign a voluntary reduction in, you know, greenhouse gases, it feels like you're not really giving them anything. You're not really empowering their bad behavior. You're just like working together to save the planet for everybody. You know, I think it depends on what the details of it are. But if your agreement is, oh, and we'll give you a bunch of fighter jets or something, then you're like, no.
I think there's also just the like the reality of if you are in an alliance with someone, it makes it harder to criticize them because, you know, they can threaten to pull out of that alliance. And again, you can accept that threat and call their bluff or something like that. But I think there is, you know, like, for example, I think we see in, you know, people like the IDW or shit like that, where like people won't criticize other people's increasing conspiracism because they're in a, you know, an alliance, a community, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. They're part of an in-group at that point. And so I do think there is, and especially like if you add on geopolitics where, you know, take for example, if America makes a treaty with a government in a small country or something like that, that like appears to be very asymmetrically beneficial to us, but in, you know, gives them a kind of legitimacy that they can then use at their particular level of conflicts to have various advantages.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that is a complication, definitely. But I feel like we should sign the treaty to reduce greenhouse gases. That's just like, you know, I don't see any downside to that. I don't know.
I guess the other downside would be, does it stop us from looking for other solutions?
What do you mean?
Does it stop us? You know, like, this is another argument that I think, I don't know where this is another, like, it could be Borgen or something like that, where sort of the idea is if you stop sort of clinging to these moderate, you know, turfy types or something like that, you actually discover that there's like another community that you can collaborate with who don't have these particular problems or something, but they weren't interested in talking to you because you were associating with Mocklins, you know?
Like there's going to be some planet of another Klingon type that has like a bunch of weapons and they're like, but we're super progressive.
We're radically gender pluralist. Yeah, exactly.
We're only making contact now that you got out of business with those Mocklins.
It's not that implausible.
Yeah, sure, sure.
I mean, if Trek teaches me anything, more of the cultures are going to likely be really open about stuff. But like, even the Klingons, I feel like, as we learned when we talked about the Klingons and transgender issues, they were much more easy to figure that kind of thing out, I think.
All right. Well, what do you think?
I guess we're about there, aren't we?
All right. Well, I think we've solved the world's problems. Major. Yeah. Diplomatic
just do the
issues.
Exact right amount of allying with just the right amount of people, just the right balance of purity politics, and you're perfect.
I think I lean more toward the realpolitik or whatever the hell. I mean, I think in certain situations, and it's precisely because of the like, you know, anti-colonialism feeling that I have. You know, like it's almost because of that it's like, we're not gonna morally dictate everybody's solutions to everything all the time. Like you need, you know, I feel like it's related to that, you know, we sometimes need to be allied with people who are doing things we don't like because we're not necessarily the world's policemen in that way, but there are definitely lines to be drawn. You know, it is like something.
And we
out.
Should definitely police those lines.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I hear you. It's tricky.
All right. Well, fortunately, in our show we watched, everything worked out for the best, and it was all... Man, they should have done my ending. Would have been so much better. Get a little... Especially... Did they do that? Because it feels like now they were setting that up. Did the old lady... Did we find out... Did I miss something?
Not to fully spoiler it for you, but also the fact that they no longer are in an alliance with the Mocklins will have basically no serious ramifications the finale of the series.
Yeah, it's just not
And
very
technology
good show.
Will save us, is the answer to the question.
You know. I feel like the fact that one thing I didn't even mention was the old lady Mocklin is the one who tells topa that like, oh, the blue thing of this is very rare, you know, blah, blah. Yep. So it makes way more sense if there should have been a scene where she like opens a drawer, sees a little, you know, little like drone.
I'm sure we'll find out we both missed it or something.
Maybe. That would be better. That would make the show better. So hopefully that happened. All right. Well, we got to do what we do each and every week. But before we do that, I think we got to make a little announcement about the future of the show. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's time, sadly.
Yes, it's as we're gearing up toward episode 200, major milestone. It's time that I announce my departure back to my home planet, whichever one that happens to be.
I'm going back to where I came from. No, yeah, you asked if I could find someone else to trade off on the show, which I think is perfectly reasonable and understandable. And we're going to talk about that some more on the next show, that it is reasonable and understandable. But we wanted to tease at least that you were going to be headed off after episode 200. But luckily, we have someone who has graciously agreed to take over in a way that I think people will enjoy while also missing you.
I think we've replaced me in a way that will really take all sting out of me. It's going to make it very easy for everybody to move on. And that's good. That's a good thing, because it's best for everybody. So I'm excited. I think the three of us are going to be on next show, right?
That's right. Next show, we will have our new co-host on for a friendly, fun handing off / going away party. And then we will shoot you out of a rocket back to where you came from.
You put me in an escape pod. It doesn't have to be a rocket. Jeez.
I mean, they're all rockets. They're just nicely designed, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, more on that next episode. Lots of thoughts and everything. More on that next time. But yeah, no, it's going to be a fun time next episode to do that handoff. And more on that later. With that said, that is motivating our choice of content next week. So what are we talking about next week?
Yeah, and we were having a little discussion about this. We originally were thinking Edge of Tomorrow because of the sort of repeating nature of that, and because it's a fun one, and we've talked about it a bunch before. But then, of course, I had to make things worse by remembering that this is actually, I think, the perfect tie-in to the most recent David Cronenberg movie that just came out on Hulu that is not his best work, but it's, I think, a really interesting piece about the relationship between artist and art and like the things we create and how we create them in this really messed up world sometimes. So we're going to talk about that. And of course, it means that you have to deal with just a little bit more of me being weird and Cronenberg-y. But given that we just did that wonderful multi-Cronenberg arc, I think there's something nice to resolving it in this kind of way. And I think when you watch the movie, you'll understand that, like, you can see where I'm coming from about why this ties in nicely.
Yep. I'm not going to lie. I was really wanting to watch Edge of Tomorrow.
I know.
Totally on brand that you're like, no, watch this disgusting thing instead, probably, whatever it is.
Yep.
But will do. I mean, I follow orders.
To the bitter end, right?
Until I'm launched out of that escape pod, I'm under your command here. So will do. What's the name of that thing again?
It is called Crimes of the Future, I want to say. Crimes of the Future.
Oh, wow. You actually got it right. It wasn't like a couple letters off.
I got all the words right.
Mimes of Mortensen the Future, I think it's called. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mimes of the Future. Right.
That'd be cool.
It's got a lot of good people in it. It's a interesting piece.
All right. Well, watch Crimes of the Future. And we've got to do what we do every week. Oh, no, I already said that. And we've also, of course, got to see what our top patrons are making you say this time.
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you. But as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
Yeah, thanks to our strong AI patrons, coffee and antidepressants is not breakfast. It's a philosophical debate on taxonomy of breakfast there. Big Easy Blasphemy, I like boobs and I'm tired of pretending I don't. It's fair. Dude, Corey Ebert, Jesta, That Bastard, Neil Polzin, Jesse Urbinowitz and Brenda Goodman, Alex Arnett, and all the thanks to our absolutely, definitely not a clone that we created to solve all of our ethical problems by sacrificing you, patron. Ice Cube or Ice Tea, I'm not sure.
Who's making someone pretend they don't like boobs? That's interesting. Maybe, yeah. I'm glad they're not putting up with that anymore.
The patriarchy. Yeah. I think it's the patriarchy.
All right. Well, we'll see everybody next week. And of course, we'll see our patrons for some bonus extra here on the After Dark. So ta-ta for now.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.
Right.